Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
The head of Russia's Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has claimed to have captured Bakhmut on Saturday and vowed to transfer control of the city to the Russian army by the 1st of June. But Kyiv says it still controls parts of the city. Also, the US has distanced itself from an incursion into Russia, which Moscow says ended in the defeat of armed insurgents who entered from Ukraine. But questions remain to be answered about exactly who those attackers were. Well, I'm joined by Scott Lucas, Professor of International Politics at UCD's Clinton Institute, and Sean Bell, former fighter pilot and Royal Air Force Vice Marshal and now military analyst. You're both welcome. Scott, I'd start with you because Prigozhin seems to say something contradictory every second day. He now says that the Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut, but it's not really that straightforward, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, the immediate story, Claire, if you're focused narrowly on Bakhmut, is that there may be some Ukrainian defenders in the southwest corner of the city. Significantly there, that's close to two highways that go into Bakhmut, which really means that what they're doing is they're protecting their way out if they eventually leave even that pocket. But the reason why not just Prigozhin's statements, but some of the coverage has been misleading about it is that at best, this may be a Pyrrhic victory for Russia and for the mercenaries, because even in the past week and a half, as Prigozhin was trying to claim victory, Ukrainian forces have been advancing to the north and to the south of Bakhmut, taking several key positions, including the heights over the city. Why is that important? Because it could mean that they could threaten to surround Prigozhin and the Wagner Group forces. And indeed, Prigozhin said that the Wagner Group are going to withdraw within a few days and be replaced by conventional Russian troops, mm-hmm. something that Moscow has not confirmed. And the big question, Claire, that we can talk about is that even if they hold Bakhmut, the fact is that the wider Eastern Front is one where Ukraine is preparing for a counteroffensive, which is likely to take a whole swathe of territory if successful. So you hold Bakhmut. In other words, you win that small battle, but you lose the bigger war.
Do you agree with all of that, Sean, with that assessment from Scott?
I do. I think it's also worth just pointing out, though, that Prigozhin, as his Wagner group of mercenaries has prevailed over the Russian army, and he would want to claim credit, and therefore almost certainly Prigozhin announced that the Wagner group had taken Bakhmut slightly early because he wouldn't have wanted the Russian information machine to credit the Russian army, because Putin's been very slow to recognize the role of the mercenary group in this war, largely because private military companies are actually illegal in Russia. There's an irony there. So, but no, otherwise, I think the likelihood whether Ukraine is able to encircle is a different issue. But I think there is nothing in the city now. Therefore, if they were able to do that, all the Russian forces within the city would be very vulnerable. I'm not sure we've heard the last of Bakhmut just yet.
And do you think that this offensive on the Eastern Front is coming from Ukraine?
Well, yeah, the expectation is, yes. I mean, the Western support, if you look back, the Ukrainians have done a stoically brave job of resisting the Russian invasion and have pushed back. They've taken back over half the territory they once had. But, of course, there's been a massive inflow of Western weapons, tanks, artillery, long-range artillery, Storm Shadow, all of which is preparing for the long-anticipated offensive. The challenge, of course, is where is this going to happen and what is its aim? At the moment, Ukraine still claims it wants to rid all of its soil of any Russians, including on Crimea and the full extent of the Donbass. Most of the military analysts, I've been interested to hear Scott's view, think that's highly unlikely they'll be able to achieve that. So the question is, how much land will they be able to liberate? Will they be able to do it in one go? What will be the cost to Ukraine? And where will that leave both sides at the end of this summer? Lots of imponderables there.
Scott, let's talk about what I mentioned there, the fact that the US has distanced itself from this reported incursion into Russia. These are Russian claims about the area of Belgorod. What do we know about what happened there?
Well, what we know is that the main militia, anti-Kremlin militia, which has claimed responsibility for the raids into the Belgorod region, taking out a Russian border post, attacking at least two villages. The Freedom of Russian Legion is connected to Ukraine's military and to Ukrainian military intelligence. They're one of the number of what's called foreign legions. Some are made up of Belarusians, some of Russians, who have been fighting with the Ukrainian military. There's one official who has privately told a journalist named Christopher Miller, yes, you know, we do have links with them, we're cooperating with them. The very fact that the Freedom of Russian Legion crossed from Ukrainian territory into Russia implies that, yes, there's at least some logistical cooperation with Ukrainian authorities. Even if Ukraine's not going to admit that, just as the Ukrainian authorities will not acknowledge the drone strikes that they're carrying out on a regular basis, all of this is to do two things. One is it is to degrade Russian capabilities in advance of that possible Ukrainian counteroffensive, hitting oil installations, hitting railway lines, hitting other supply lines. And the second thing is it's really to highlight the fact that there are Russians who are willing to fight against Vladimir Putin, and that there is unrest, as it were, not just within Russia in terms of specific Russian militias, but even division at the higher levels, for example, between Prigozhin and between the Kremlin, that far from achieving victory, the signs of this attack in the Belgorod region is that Russia is in a position of weakness.
Mm-hmm. And Sean, to talk about the commitment from allies of Ukraine to keep going with the assistance, both humanitarian and military. Now, the F-16 fighter jets, we know the allies have agreed to train Kyiv's pilots, but no country is ready yet to actually donate the jets, for now at least.
No, and it's really interesting. I mean, headlines, obviously, President Zelensky has been asking for this capability for a year. And finally, at the G7 conference in Japan, the green light was given from President Biden that they could be given. The trouble is, if you look behind the rhetoric, I mean, as a former fighter pilot myself, the F-16 came into service in the late 70s. So it's quite an old aircraft. It's been regularly upgraded. There's lots of midlife upgrades. But it's not clear about what version of the F-16 that the Ukraine is going to be given. They probably won't get the newest version. There are several nations that are retiring their F-16 fleets because they're moving to the new Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35. And the nearest I can come to analogy is that the F-16 first came to service about the time Volkswagen Golfs, the Mark 1, first appeared on our roads. Now, the latest version of the Golf is the Mark 8. And that bears no similarity, really, in terms of technology to the Mark 1. And it's all very well saying we're going to give F-16s to Ukraine, but the challenge is it's not about the platform. It's about the radar, the defensive aids, the electronic warfare, the weapons, etc. And the older that these aircraft are given, the less likely it is that they will be a comparable match to their Russian adversary. So there's a lot of work behind the scene, I think, that needs to be done yet before we translate this announcement into a credible military capability.
But what about the symbolism of the ongoing support that Ukraine is getting?
That is the most important, from my perspective, piece of this announcement, is that President Putin will have hoped, most analysts believe, that he would expect the West's appetite for this war to wane significantly as the year came to an end. But actually, the provision of F-16s, because it's not just about the aircraft, it's spares, it's weapons, it's people, it's training. That is a long-term commitment to the long-term provision of combat air capability for Ukraine. That is something that's a clear declaration from the international community that they're with Ukraine for the long term. And undoubtedly, that will be a major cause for concern for Putin, despite his rhetoric in response.
You'd wonder, though, is there a time limit on that, Scott? Because I saw the former head of the British Army about a week ago, Sir Richard Dannett, saying that Ukraine would have to make significant progress in the next number of months because the support might just pull back to a certain extent, which is what Vladimir Putin, of course, is counting on.
Well, look, there were headlines in the spring of 2022 that even though the Russians had failed to take Kyiv, that Europe, the United States, and the international community wouldn't back Ukraine. There were headlines last summer when Russia did advance in the east that support would break. There were headlines over the winter during Putin's energy war that Europe and the U.S. would walk away. The fact of the matter is, I'll make two points. The first is that it's the squeaky wheels that get the grease, because there are a lot of pro-Kremlin activists, both from the right and from the left, including in Ireland, they tend to get a lot of the publicity because there's a few congressmen in the United States that say, oh, we're going to cut off funding. They're the ones that get the headlines. The second complementary point is that the reality is that the public opinion surveys in the U.S., in Europe, in other countries like Australia, is that public support is remaining relatively constant for the support of Ukraine. And as we have seen, the provision of military assistance has not decreased. It continues to be provided to the Ukrainians. So, no, I think everyone realizes this is not a sprint. This is more of a marathon. But at this point, if you were to ask me whether I would rather be in Vladimir Putin's position or Vladimir Zelensky's position, I know which one I would take. It would be with Kyiv, which still maintains a large degree of support from the international community on the economic, political, and military fronts.
And you don't think, Sean, do you, that there's any chance that that is going to wane if something doesn't happen in Ukraine's favor in the coming months?
Well, it's a great question. The trouble is there isn't a binary response for it. I absolutely agree with Scott's analysis. The one caveat I would say is that the one advantage that the West has been able to provide Kyiv is high-tech weapons. And unfortunately, none of the West buys any more of these weapons than they need. They're put into stockpiles, carrying a little bit of risk. And what the political judgment has been is we can take further risk by giving some of those weapons to Ukraine. The problem is that's not an unlimited supply. You can't nip down to the supermarket and just buy a few more. And the production line for these things is often long since closed. So we are running out of some of these high-tech weapons. There are various initiatives in place to try to generate new stocks of more modern supplies. But it is a bit of a military challenge. But the political and economic lines of support, I'm sure, will endure. But the thing that's made the big difference on the battlefield has been the weapons. That is going to be a challenge if this extends into next year.
Thank you both, Sean Bell, military analyst, and Professor Scott Lucas, for talking to us today. Coming up next, we'll be telling you, or rather giving you some suggestions as to what to do with the bountiful amount of summer fruit that we'll see in the coming weeks and months.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.